Today, we speak to the National Coordinator of Momentum and now a European election candidate about people who love Corbyn but hate Brexit. And Jason Burke on the South African elections, as the party of Nelson Mandela looks likely to hang on, but with a reduced majority. The decision to leave the EU created a precarious balancing act for the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, trying to respect the original Brexit result, but also the strong desire of most Labour members to hold a second referendum. Yesterday, when he launched his party's European election campaign, Corbyn insisted he could still straddle this bitter divide.
It's said that Labour is trying to offer something for everyone over Brexit. I make no apology for that.
Laura Parker has watched all of this unfold from the inside. First as a volunteer in Corbyn's original leadership campaign, then as private secretary in his Westminster office, before becoming the national coordinator of the campaign group Momentum. Now as a candidate in the European elections, she has become much more upfront about her desire for Labour to secure a second referendum and then campaign to remain. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what do you do when you love Corbyn but hate Brexit? Laura, you've been a lifelong left-winger. But as far as the Labour Party is concerned, your story begins in 2015. You came back to the UK after a period living and working in continental Europe, just in time to see Labour's defeat in that year's election under Ed Miliband. Can you remember how you felt?
So I was devastated at the result. I was obviously pleased then that there was an opportunity to have a leadership election and delighted at the idea that Jeremy might get on the ballot paper. I've heard 100 times from John McDonnell the story of how they squeezed him onto the ballot paper at the last moment. And so many of us were so pleased that they did. And I just decided then that I needed to do more. And so I became a volunteer on the Corbyn election campaign in 2015.
So what was that like? What were you doing?
Oh, it was fantastic. I used to kind of go to work early in the morning so I could get out a bit earlier and pedal up to a phone bank and just phone people. It was brilliant. One night I rang Liverpool and every single person I rang from the Liverpool Labour Party said that they were going to vote and they were only going to vote for one person and they were voting for Corbyn.
So this inspiration that's been the last 100 days doesn't end on Saturday. Saturday is simply one staging post in it.
I went to the final rally in Union Chapel and someone plonked me on a stage in a T-shirt and so I sat behind Corbyn when he did his speech.
Of all of us, the aspiration of good housing, of good schools, of good opportunities, the aspiration of an end to discrimination, to racism, the aspiration to end poverty and misery within our society. All these things are possible if we're strong enough, determined enough and courageous enough to bring it about. Thank you very much for being here tonight.
The excitement was palpable.
And many of the MPs, much of the press, were completely shocked about the result. But clearly a lot of people were really enthused and excited. I mean, when he walked in to find the result, he was surrounded by young people jostling around him, singing the red flag.
No cowards flinch and traitor stare. We'll keep the red flag flying here.
Chanting Jez We Can. And what was it at the time that you felt was possible for the Labour Party then? In terms of your politics, what did you want to see happen?
Well, I'd spent 15 years working with some of the most marginalised communities in Europe and coming back to the UK the same, working with children in the child protection system. And Corbyn talked about inequality.
We don't have to be unequal. It doesn't have to be unfair. Poverty isn't inevitable.
And there just was a language that had disappeared from British politics. He talked about taking a side. You know, he talked about, unembarrassedly, about taxing the rich, about protecting people who are homeless, love, care. I mean, these words appeared in the vocabulary that we'd just not heard. Finally, I felt that this was a totally different approach to how the country should be run.
And all that excitement, all that activism, the friends you made at the phone banks, the kind of campaign for Jeremy, tell me what becomes of it next.
Well, we all realise there's lots to do. And so the first thing that happened to me, I think, was that I went off to a meeting in Southwark where, I don't know, 50 people squeezed into a room for 20. And we talked about what we thought we could do, what campaigns we were interested in, how we would organise ourselves. I think early discussions about what we might be called. And that was really the birth of Momentum.
What were the other names you were thinking about?
I've got a very bad memory, which is probably just as well, because I think most of them were terrible, but I think Swarm was on the list.
What did you mean by Swarm?
Well, that wasn't my suggestion.
So did you think people would swarm to Jeremy?
I've got no idea.
And so just from the very outset, what was Momentum?
Momentum became the glue, really, that brought us all together and connected us with other activists in other parts of the country and encouraged some of us to maybe get involved more in the Labour Party.
So basically, Momentum emerged as a pro-Jeremy campaign group. But some people depicted you as a kind of far-left splinter group, a party within a party. I mean, it was presented in quite a sinister way. How did you feel about that at the time?
I think when people have run out of political road, they go on the attack. And really what most of that was about was people who could not reconcile themselves to the change in politics that was happening. And I have never recognised myself or indeed the people that I've spent the last 3 years with in any of those descriptions. I mean, the people running the food banks for Momentum up in the north of England or creating apps so that migrants can connect with lawyers for free advice or running anti-library closure campaigns. I mean, these are not far left. You know, they're not crazy ideas for a start, but the sinister description of Momentum was just designed to undermine the politics.
So at this point, in the early days, you're a fairly small cog in a local branch of Momentum. And then all of a sudden, you find yourself right at the centre of the movement. You applied and successfully became Jeremy Corbyn's private secretary. And you arrived in the job 3 weeks before the EU referendum. Now, Corbyn got a lot of stick for not campaigning hard enough. I mean, he famously rated his passion for the EU at...
Oh, I'd put myself in the upper half of the 5 to 10. So we're looking at seven and a half.
Seven and a half out of 10. Was the criticism fair?
Well, if I was asked, I would say 7 out of 10. And I'm an ardent Remainer. But it's a nonsense to pretend that the EU is perfect. I actually think of all the things that Jeremy's been criticised for, that one really least holds water. I actually think it's a pretty nuanced and reasonable assessment. I mean, I want to remain in the EU, but I want it to be transformed. I want it to adopt a different politics in terms of austerity, a braver politics in terms of freedom of movement, migrants' rights. I want it to be more transparent in terms of the institution. So actually, I thought that criticism was completely unfair. In terms of the campaign, I will never forget the day Jeremy went to do a speech. And all the big guns from the media were there, so, you know, this hadn't been missed. And indeed, all the big guns asked Jeremy questions, and we went back to the office to watch the news report, turned on the TV to have a minute and a half of Boris Johnson doing some stunt, auctioning a cow in protest at the Common Agricultural Policy.
960 pounds for this beautiful, beautiful Ribble Valley reared. What is she? Beautiful milker, beautiful cow. She's looking lovely.
Now, it is true that Corbyn did not have rallies of 50,000 people around the country like in 2017. yes, we should have run a campaign like we did in 2017.
Going on. Sold. There you go.
I regret that we didn't. But it is untrue that he didn't campaign.
And how did you feel on the morning of June the 24th?
Tired and fed up. I mean, for someone like me, I say repeatedly, it's quite difficult to conceive of how I leave the EU. It's not just some bureaucratic construct. I mean, I'm married to an Italian. My niece is Spanish. Many of my closest friends are Bulgarian. I lived, you know, in continental Europe for 17, 18 years of my life. My husband and I haven't yet figured out how it all works in terms of bureaucracy, but I don't, you know, leaving for me is a nonsense. So I was really devastated, actually, and torn, and like many people, very, very conflicted. I felt the rules of the referendum were appallingly constructed. However, those were the rules which our parliament accepted. So, yeah, it was difficult.
And for the Labour Party, I mean, everyone was talking about the fact that a majority of constituencies had backed Brexit, but a majority of Labour voters were pro-Remain. Did you know then that this would go on to cause years of tension for the party?
I think I did know that it would be complicated. Perhaps not quite this complicated, because, of course, then we had the election.
The Prime Minister calls for a snap general election to be held on Thursday, June the 8th. In a surprise announcement, Theresa May said she had recently and reluctantly come to the decision.
And that was important because before it, the best ardent Remainers could have hoped for was a soft Brexit. The Tories had a majority and were massively ahead in the polls, so it looked like they would make it even bigger. And then the election actually started. I mean, I covered it for The Guardian.
This is a car park in Reading. How much notice do they get?
About 2 days.
Which, it turns out, is plenty of time to draw a crowd for Jeremy Corbyn.
I remember people waiting for hours in the rain to see him.
Corbyn's shown he can get thousands to turn up at rallies. Now he needs millions to turn out and vote Labour.
And on polling day, it did translate into that shock result. He stripped Theresa May of her majority. The new parliament was much more Remain-leaning. And that was a massive turning point, wasn't it?
I mean, it was, literally, but I'm not sure how much we thought about it then. I still have a sense that we didn't really start to take Brexit seriously enough until 2018.
So by this point, you've decided to leave Corbyn's office and you go to work for Momentum, but this time in a much more prominent capacity. You become their national coordinator. How big of an issue was Brexit at this point?
So I suppose it's creeping up the agenda because the dust has settled on the 2017 election and people are tuning into the fact that the Tories really are making a hash of it.
In the UK, the British Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, has quit. Let's go straight to 10 Downing Street.
So Boris Johnson now resigning will come as a double hammer blow, but it will ring so much louder than that blow of David Davis leaving.
So fast forward into 2018. In the summer, the Tories publish their Chequers Brexit plan and tensions for them really boil over. But it's becoming very difficult for Labour too. And then in the autumn at the party's annual conference, they finally come up with a second referendum policy. And some criticise it for being a bit of a fudge.
Well, I think it's much misunderstood. For me, it's really clear what that conference policy says. You know, it recognises complexity. It understands that not everyone across the party agrees or everyone across the country agrees. It makes it very clear that the Labour Party thinks that actually the thing the country most needs is a change of government, with which, of course, I agree. But then it also makes it clear that if the government is confident of its Brexit deal, it shouldn't be afraid to put that deal to a public vote. Those words are in black and white in our conference policy.
And you go to your members to find out what they think of Brexit.
Yes, so we did a survey of our membership, and in many ways the Momentum members are in the same place as most Labour Party members. So I think 82% said that they thought Brexit would be bad for their families, communities. That a majority believe in a public vote if there's no general election. In fact, a sizable number support a public vote in all circumstances. Momentum's members, as far as this survey demonstrates, are in the same place as Labour Party members.
Which is incredibly pro-EU and pretty anti-Brexit. And yet there are people on the left of Labour who think that those pushing for a second referendum, for example, are largely centrists who want to get rid of Corbyn. How do you, in your position, knowing that your members feel the way they do, grapple with that tension?
I think a lot of people recognise that, in fact, there are sizable numbers on the left who are pro-EU and who have reached the conclusion that some sort of public vote is the best way out of this mess. I remember it being suggested at a meeting that I was at that it was all just people like Chuckramunna who supported a people's vote. That's just lazy. It's not true.
Do you think the leader's office believe it's not true?
I really don't know. There are enough MPs from the decidedly pro-Corbyn left and certainly enough Labour Party members and people like me who have reached the conclusion that some sort of public vote is needed that I don't believe they can believe that.
So during all of this, we start seeing those love Corbyn, hate Brexit t-shirts. I mean, you couldn't miss them. Where did they come from?
Do you know, I don't know. And I haven't actually got one.
if I sent you one, would you wear it?
I think the love-hate thing, I might struggle slightly. You know, I always resist the notion that we're some sort of cult in Momentum, so the love Corbyn might be a bit much. And the hate Brexit, I mean, yeah, I guess I do hate Brexit, but I wouldn't want to ever be misunderstood that I hate people who voted for it. So I'm a bit uncomfy with some of that because I know lots of people who voted to leave. Some of my family voted leave. Some of my, you know, some of my friends, some of my colleagues. So actually, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a great slogan, but.
So you've been quite nuanced through a lot of this. You've been careful not to come clearly out. You've not kind of spoken about your view on Brexit whilst both the Labour Party and Momentum have grappled to deal with this, which is incredibly divisive, not just for the country, but for the left as well. And then during a People's Vote March, you decided to take to the streets and you even got up on a stump and you started speaking out against Brexit.
I don't think we're here today because we want to talk about the fucking single market. We are here today because we want solidarity. We want human rights. We want workers' rights. We want empathy and we want love.
So can I just ask you to take your Momentum hat off for a minute? You're standing as a Labour candidate in the European elections this month. What had changed for you that day?
In a way, I kind of hung on in there with lots of the process in Parliament, and I reached a point when I just thought that it was very disempowering and the clock was ticking. And in parallel with this, there's been a frightening rise of support for far-right parties. You know, my husband lives in Italy, where they've got fascists in government. They're public buildings that the police have not been able to go in when fascists have been holding protests. You've got Orban in Hungary, Le Pen sitting in the European Parliament, and now Tommy Robinson standing for election. And then, of course, the rights of EU nationals, which have been trampled over, and 1.3 million people who still don't know really what's going to happen to them, though they've made our country their home. So I guess we got to that demo and someone said to me, what we do now will define us. And in the end, I am very loyal to the Corbyn political project and I don't want to make mischief for the Labour Party. And I understand the complexities of the situation, but ultimately we must each stand up for what we believe in. And I believe that Brexit is a bad idea.
And you actually wrote an article for us in The Guardian where you essentially argued that there needs to be another referendum and that Labour needs to be the party of Remain. That takes away some of those complexities that you've talked about. Aren't you ignoring the fact that many in the party just don't agree with you on that?
But many do. The vast majority of Labour Party members do. The vast majority of Labour Party activists do. Ultimately, Parliament has demonstrated that it's incapable of finding an answer. It doesn't seem that these negotiations are going to go very well with government. I don't think any, you know, none of our trade union leaders who've been into Number 10 to talk to Theresa May have come out reassured that she's telling them the truth about workers' rights. I mean, John McDonnell said something at the weekend about negotiating with the government is like trying to enter into a contract with a company that's going into administration. We know that this government is on its knees. So it doesn't seem that these negotiations are going to lead to very much. And I think in the end, given the complexities and the impossibilities of resolving it, paradoxically, that means we do have to decide to take a side. I don't see that there's another way out. And the Labour Party argued to Remain on the 23rd of June for good reason, because it's an internationalist party. It believes in solidarity. We know we need to work together to protect workers' rights. We need to work together to tackle climate change. We have to work together to take on the far right. And I want to see a left-wing government sitting at the table with those 27 member states. I think it would be the greatest tragedy, really, if we get Jeremy Corbyn elected in the UK and he's sitting on his own in Westminster. I want him to be banging heads together in Brussels.
But look, the Labour Party doesn't have an anti-Brexit position at the moment. It's still a second referendum only in some circumstances. And Jeremy Corbyn this week made clear that wasn't changing. Given that there are other clear Remain parties like the Greens, the Lib Dems, Change UK, how do you persuade people to vote Labour if they really want to stop Brexit?
Well, first of all, by having some of this conversation. Also because I don't believe there's this massive difference between some Labour people who voted Leave and Labour people who voted Remain. In the end, they are Labour people with Labour values. On the fundamentals, we want the same things. We want to end inequality. You know, we want to invest in public services. I also believe that, you know, Labour voters are sophisticated people and some of them will have had the same internal conflicts that I have had. But ultimately, it's the radical politics of the Labour Party in the UK and elsewhere that we need.
Does it sadden you that the kind of optimism that perhaps you and others had when you were on the phone bank persuading people to back Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader, all those left-wing ideas that were resonating about the possibility of a changed society? Are you sad that Brexit is now so dominant in the debate and that the left can't really agree on a position?
Look, I think it's obviously frustrating. It's sucking the air out of political discussion and everyone is obsessing about the EU. But I'm still really optimistic about all the things that we can change. I mean, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn has changed the narrative, not just in the UK, but across Europe, about austerity. Of course, it's frustrating, but we're just in a different place. I mean, it's a bit like the difference between, I don't know, the buzz the day you get married and a few years in when you're having breakfast on a Thursday morning and it's raining. I mean, of course, it's not excitement and hearts and flowers all the time, but it's no less meaningful.
Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Laura Parker. Do follow the reporting of our Westminster team on the European elections, on Labour and all the other parties taking part at theguardian.com. Coming up, do the South African elections mark a turning point for the ANC? Welcome back. Now The Guardian's Africa correspondent Jason Burke on the South African elections, in which the ANC look likely to hold on to power, but by the smallest majority they've had in the 25 years since the country's first free elections.
I think it's difficult to explain to people outside the country quite how the ANC are part of the identity of South Africa. Nelson Mandela is a kind of secular saint. He was an ANC leader. He is the one person who embodies the vision and the dream of South Africa. That has enormous resonance and significance for everybody. The ANC are looking to relaunch themselves under Cyril Ramaphosa, the president who took power last year. And they were hoping for a launch pad, if you like, in these elections. And a big win would have given them that launch pad. They haven't got that big win. They haven't got that launch pad. The ANC has been losing support at successive elections for about 15 years now. Having gone through a decade of very complicated, chaotic, populist rule by Jacob Zuma, a period that was marked by successive corruption scandal allegations and a general deterioration in the economy, an awful lot of South Africans have decided that enough is enough. It's a slightly odd campaign in that there are two main issues. One is the future of the ANC and who should run the ANC. And the second is what's happening in the country, which is the one that concerns most voters, clearly most directly, is all about unemployment that is officially at 27%, but everyone knows it's much, much higher, at violence that is rising again after a period of dropping, a murder rate that is off the charts, inequality indicators that are either the worst or very much among the worst in the world, the degree to which the wealth of the country has not been redistributed 25 years after apartheid is really very obvious as well. And there is significant anger about that. A lot of analysts were looking at this election as saying, can Cyril Ramaphosa turn this around, reform the ANC, turn it into something that is modern, contemporary, has answers to the modern contemporary problems that South Africa faces? Or is it a party that had its moment of historic significance 25 years ago and has been on a downslide ever since? I spoke to people, senior people in the ANC, who were talking about how there's a moral crisis in the party and that they need the votes of South Africans to address that moral crisis. But in the end, it looks like an awful lot of South Africans have decided for that after 25 years, something new should be introduced into the South African political scene. I don't think we're going to see any radical, dramatic changes in the months or possibly years to come. And that could well be to the detriment of 50 million plus South Africans.
That was Jason Burke. You can find more of his reporting at the website. My thanks to him today and to Laura Parker. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executives are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.